able to replay it later, or you know, I'll pass it out to people who were unable to make the live version. They can go ahead and hit record. Okay. So hopefully what you're seeing in front of you now is a slide presentation with a lovely Japanese garden on PowerPoint. And so that's generally what you're going to be looking at. Okay, someone cannot hear. All right, let me fix the technical difficulties first. Okay, we have one person who can't hear. Let me try to fix that. If you're just joining us, welcome. We're going to get started in a minute or so, trying to fix some technical difficulties here. Okay, so all right, so I'm suggesting that if there's at least one person who can't hear me, that they just dial in on the phone instead of going online, because other people online can seem to hear. Okay. All right, I'm going to jump in. Please use the chat box along the way if there are questions, but I would also sort of pause for questions along the way. And also, you can email me in as well if you... I'll have my email up if for some reason you're having any kind of difficulties on the session. Okay. All right. So welcome, everyone. We're discussing international estate law today, and this is basically kind of some foundational concepts. Well, and then some. It's more kind of an intermediate program, but I promise I will cover foundational concepts first. Okay, so people are streaming. Hang on here. They're streaming now. And not the slide.
Mark Howard?
All right, great. We're on. Okay, we had some screen sharing issues, but there we go. Okay. All right, so let's get started. You got to love technology. I just can't stand it. Okay. So what I want to start first is talking about kind of the background of the international client, or what I call the multinational client. And regardless of what practice you're in, you are going to see there has been for a good 20 years, and there will continue to be a real uptick in the multinational, meaning the person who has a relationship with more than one country. And that relationship can be personal, it can be financial, and it certainly affects their estate if either one of those things is in their profile. So years ago when I started practice, I wanted to know why that was. And so I'm going to give a little bit of background on the sort of the rise of the multinational and where they're coming from, and what the patterns are. And I fully expect, you know, these things to simply continue exponentially, you know, as time goes on. And history has certainly proven that out. So first of all, I have some international travel statistics. This just goes on to show that there has been just a market increase in the way we move about the world. That it used to be a very big deal for someone to kind of get on an international flight and go somewhere, and that just isn't the case, especially from the U.S., because the U.S. is kind of far removed from, you know, other places. We've got to get on a plane to go and take a fairly long trip, even just to get across our own country, let alone into another country. In European countries, you know, people sort of hop on flights all the time. It's not a big deal. They're incredibly inexpensive. But that's certainly not the case coming to or from the United States. So in 1996, about 20 million people from the U.S. traveled overseas. And that number went up to 40 million in 2008. You can see in a very short span of time, it doubled. And it got even more, 68 million in 2014. Most countries people are going to, Mexico and Canada, obviously you're going to see those everywhere, but the UK and the Dominican Republic were also close in line. In 1996, 46 million people visited the U.S., so these are the people coming to the U.S. That rose to 58 million in 2008 and 75 million in 2014. So there is no slowdown here as far as people coming in and out. And these are just visitors, right? These are people who just want to check out a new place. For all of you, you know, people who love travel, like I do, that's what people are doing. One of the reasons is the cost has gone, is much lower than it ever used to be. The average airline ticket price fell by 33% in about a 20-year span between in the mid-70s to mid-90s. That is adjusted for inflation, so that's actually a noticeable difference there, you know, so that people can travel.
So, right
now. Okay, let's talk about immigration. So here we're talking about legal immigration. We're not talking about illegal immigration. That's a whole different topic. I don't know a whole lot about that, but we're talking about legal immigration. So in 2016, over a million people, about 1.1 million people became legal permanent residents in the U.S. I'm going to ask everyone, if you are on the seminar, could you please mute your line, because I'm hearing talking. So you can mute your line. You can mute your line by going up. If you're online, you can go up to the task bar up there. There's a picture of a little microphone. If everyone could just click that and make sure that you're muted, I would appreciate that. If you're on the phone, just hit the mute button on your phone. Ooh, that's much better. Okay, thank you. All right. So in 2016, over a million people became legal permanent residents of the U.S., meaning that they have a green card, that they are able to stay here for an extended period of time, 5 years or 10 years. It kind of depends on the situation. They're not just visiting, but they're not citizens either. You know, they're not able to be here forever. But legal permanent residents, over a million, that's just in 2016. The basis of that, 800,000 of those is based on family, meaning that they have a family member here, and they were sponsored by someone, so they're joining a family member here. 137,000 of that is based on employment, meaning that they were offered employment here, and usually an employer has to show something like, you know, we've looked around at other U.S. people and they don't have the skill set. You know, these tend to be a lot of those tend to be highly skilled workers. And there's also, you know, a number of unskilled workers that can come in as well. 157,000 of those were refugees or asylum seekers. So these are people fleeing a really bad situation in a country. And so let's ask, where are these folks coming from? So 42% are coming from Mexico. Again, you're going to see Mexico and Canada a lot. And the Caribbean, obviously, that's nearby. 37% is coming from Asia. So these numbers are the 2016 numbers. If we were to go back 20 years and then 40 years, you're going to see a very different makeup of countries of immigration coming to the U.S. You know, if you went to the mid-50s, you're going to see a lot of Europeans. You know, now in 2016, saw almost 40% is coming from Asia. That's China, India, Vietnam, Philippines, and, you know, I don't need to explain why that is. The world is changing. You know, you've got emerging markets there, and so you have a lot of folks coming from Asia. Only 8% from Europe, you know, a big change from the way it used to be 40, 50 years ago. 9% from Africa. Where are all these immigrants headed? They are headed to right where I am, which is the New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania area. Okay, so you have New York City, you have Philadelphia, you have New Jersey, which is essentially Philadelphia South or New York North. Sorry for anyone from New Jersey on here, but we are a megalopolis on the East Coast of the United States, and that's where most immigrants are coming from. The busiest immigration office is the Newark, New Jersey office. That's where lots of folks come from. Secondly is the Los Angeles area, no big surprise, second biggest city. Miami area, very international place. The D.C. area, Washington, D.C., obviously very international. And also Chicago, because, again, it's a very large city. Okay. Let's talk about citizens. So we've talked about, like, residents who are coming here and kind of forming an initial relationship with the U.S. But what about citizens? Who are the people who decide to stay here permanently? Okay. Or at least have citizenship permanently. I have to qualify that. All right, so citizens between 1908 and 1990, every year in that time frame, we had under 300,000 naturalizations, except for two of those years. So what's a naturalization? It's when someone goes from that legal permanent resident status to citizen. Okay. So you've got to be here for a little while with a legal permanent status before you actually can become a citizen. You know, you can't just kind of sign up from overseas and then show up a citizen. So what are those 2 years? So think about, if anyone's in the chat box, can anyone guess what the 2 years were between 1908 and 1990 where we had more than 300,000 naturalizations? Any guesses? Yeah, okay, so we had a 1945 gap. That's right in line. It was actually 42, 43. That's exactly right. It is end of World War II, or, you know, as World War II people needed to escape, you know, and that's exactly what they were doing. And fortunately, the U.S. was housing those folks to get out of a really bad situation, and so we had more than 300,000 naturalizations. Okay. Since 1990, naturalizations have exceeded 300,000 every year. Every year. In 2008, over a million people became citizens, and that was the record at that time. In 2016, 750—the most recent numbers I've got—753,000 became citizens. Just to compare, so we're just under a million people becoming citizens. Where do most of those folks live? Okay, so again, these are citizens. California is number one, big state. Los Angeles, you know, big cities. Florida, again, you know, Miami area, very international. Texas, we also know why that is. And again, there's the East Coast megalopolis of New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. The leading countries for naturalization are Mexico. India is now number two. Philippines is number three. China is number four. So there again, we have the more recent patterns of Asia immigrants, you know, making their ties with the U.S. And then Dominican Republic, that seems to be showing up fairly lately. And again, that's kind of, you know, in fairly recent history, Dominican Republic is doing that. And then also Vietnam, so we're back to Asia again. Okay. So those are immigration statistics for citizens. Let's talk about who leaves. Who leaves the U.S.? It is very rare for folks to kind of leave and leave the U.S. to give up their citizenship. So we had 6,800 citizenships renounced in 2017. That was a big jump. It was 26% higher than in 2016 and 56% higher than 2015. So we are going to be talking a little bit about foreign account compliance, and I know just from my personal practice that there have been a lot of very wealthy individuals who were not, who either were U.S. citizens or they had green cards or something, who have been ridding themselves of affiliation with the U.S. because they feel they were treated very badly by the IRS, and they just don't want to be bothered with our tax system anymore, which is very far-reaching, as you'll see in a moment. And so I think, at least, that is not surprising. I sat in my office in 2009, and I said, you are going to see citizens leaving this country. You are going to see a lot of wealth leaving this country, you know, if we keep treating wealthy people who pay their taxes the way that we're doing under some of these IRS programs. And at least, you know, my predictions on these numbers have borne to be correct. All right. So that's just to give an idea of U.S. immigration in and out. Let's deal with immigration myths. So there's a lot of myth, a lot of misinformation out there about immigration. And again, what I'm going to stress is that today we're talking about legal immigration, and we're not talking about illegal immigration. All right? So one of the first myths is that the word immigration applies to all situations. Okay? And it doesn't. So the first question is, are we talking legal or are we talking illegal? All right? Because we're dealing with two different populations there. So some of the myths that we're talking about here. So immigration is not at an all-time high. The all-time high still, and these are as of 2016 numbers, I believe, 14.7% of our U.S. population were immigrants, and that is as of 1910. So if most of you can think again of your history, what was going on, the Industrial Revolution was going on, it was happening here, and a lot of folks were coming for jobs, you know, we needed the labor, the U.S. needed the labor, and people needed the jobs, and so 1910, doesn't surprise me, that's been holding steady for more than 100 years, that was the highest, that was the highest percentage of immigrants made up our U.S. population. 2015, however, 14%, pretty high, that has come up, that 14% of the population was foreign-born. Okay, here's a myth. One of the myths that is out there is that immigrants take away jobs from U.S. people. That is not true. The opposite is true. Immigrants actually decrease unemployment. So to say that in a non-negative way, immigrants create jobs when they come here to the U.S. So those states with the highest immigration experience the lowest unemployment. Because immigrants come here, they create jobs, they hire U.S. people. Okay? So it's a myth. So just get the facts straight. There's a lot of people, you know, immigrants steal our jobs. No, they don't. Okay, third myth is, I shouldn't say it's a myth. The myth is that immigrants don't pay their taxes. The reality is immigrants do pay taxes. Okay? What's interesting to me is, you know, I've been talking on this subject for a while, and you know, I always stress that it's legal immigration. However, I sat on a panel a few years ago with an accountant in Texas who his entire practice was filing taxes for illegal immigrants. And it was very interesting because he said, oh, no, they all file their taxes and they pay their taxes, U.S. taxes, you know, and I was like, oh, wow, was a surprise to me. I didn't know anything about that. But he said, oh, no, you know, there's all these CPAs, their entire practice is filing and reporting taxes for illegal immigrants that are here in the U.S. working and they're reporting their wages and everything. So I thought that was fascinating. Okay. Another myth is that immigrants don't speak English. That is incorrect. Only 6% of long-term immigrants report not speaking English so well. And I always have to ask, and how many of the native-born speak English so well or so good? Okay, another myth is that immigrants are not educated. The opposite is true. Immigrants are educated. In fact, they are more educated than the average native-born U.S. person. They have one full year more of education than the average native-born. Immigrants aid research and development. They make up almost a third of PhDs in the U.S., 24% of the STEM workforce. All right, so we're always saying that, U.S. People are not educated in math, science, technology. It's true. It's true. It's been true since I was a kid. It's still true. And we rely a lot on immigration to bring those folks here and to run our companies. A lot of my practice is multinationals that are heading up pharmaceutical companies that are in very high positions in pharmaceutical companies. Again, here I am on the East Coast where we have Silicon Alley, which is what parts of New Jersey are called, and also we have a real pharmaceutical and biotech center. Philadelphia is a biotech center. And so we have a lot of multinationals in this area, and a lot of them are in science and technology and engineering. Okay, as I said before, immigrants are entrepreneurs. 12% of the fastest growing companies in the U.S. are started by immigrants. So it's a nice solid number there. Okay, let's jump into the practice of law when dealing with multinationals. Okay, let's talk about ethical issues first. So this is something attorneys and non-attorneys need to be aware of, is the unauthorized practice of law. So jurisdiction is a really big issue. One of the biggest misconceptions of my practice is people say to me, well, okay, I have a client who is, a U.S. citizen but living in Germany. Can you tell me all about the U.S. law and all about the German law? And I say, no, I cannot. I can tell you all about the U.S. law. I'm not going to say a word about German law because I'm not a German attorney. And so the first thing we need to do is to get German counsel to tell us about what's going on in Germany, because I don't know what's going on in Germany. I'm certainly not barred in Germany or allowed to practice law there, so I'm not going to comment on that area of practice. And I urge everyone else, we've got accountants and financial planners and trust folks and bank people and all that on the line, and so I would not encourage you to comment on the same thing. Don't try to practice law in an area that you don't know, that you're not barred. Certainly don't start practicing accounting or financial planning in a jurisdiction that you know nothing about. You don't know, like I always say, I don't know what I don't know in areas where, I'm not getting 10 daily email updates on how the law has changed in my own country, let alone all the others. So unauthorized practice of law is important. I'm not saying it's always an easy issue to sell, because clients don't want to hear that, you need yet another person on the team, because they think dollar signs and they don't like that. And so many people, including other advisors, will try to say to me, oh, come on, can't you just sort of look up what the law is over there in Singapore and just kind of tell me what it is? And I have to say, no, I have no intention of doing that. It's generally not as bad as people think. It's not like they're paying, two huge bills to two different attorneys in two different countries. It is often, and I do the same in the U.S., I give, I spend an hour or something looking over what someone in another country has done for someone who has a U.S. connection in some way, just to make sure that they haven't triggered anything under U.S. law that they were unaware of. I advise on that. I look. It doesn't take a lot of time at all. And many times it's a quick question that I can just answer, and there's actually no billing involved at all. And I have plenty of other advisors, some of whom are on the line, who do the same thing for me in other countries. And so there's a good cross-border community where we really kind of help each other out on that. So there's no shortage of expertise is what I'm saying. So don't put yourself in a really bad position and doing something that's not good for your client and not good for you and your practice. There's plenty of good advisors out there. Other issues that are going to come up when dealing with the multinational is disclosure of assets. Now, certainly some of you who are banking or the financial planning people, you've got to do that. You can't even take on any assets without all kinds of due diligence. And certainly at law firms, we really have to sort of check the identity of a person before we take them on as a client. We need to be careful of all of those things. But I think the banks probably take the cake with the amount of information that they need to get from a client before they work with them at all. So disclosure of assets is something that I have found over the last 20 years is a lot of, there are cultural differences, and I don't want to stereotype, but there are cultural differences or different practices in different regions or particular countries of how people deal with assets, and there is actual firm backup for that. So, for instance, in the United States and a lot of countries, tax evasion is a crime, tax fraud is a crime, right? That's just a given. However, in Switzerland, tax fraud is a crime, tax evasion is not. So there's a very different kind of a mentality in some places where it's kind of expected that, you know, people can hide their assets. There is an absolute buffer between them and the government. They would never expect that the government should have any information about their assets. And a lot of that, a lot of those walls have really been torn down in the last 10 years since the U.S. has kind of come out and said, all right, that's it. We want to know everything about our own people, whether it's in the U.S. or in other countries. A lot of other countries didn't like that and started shedding their U.S. citizen clients and saying, sorry, you can't come to our bank anymore because your government has just gone nuts with all the information they need to know about you and all the stuff we need to report about you, so we're just not doing business with you anymore. So if you've heard of FATCA, which many of us have, that all kind of came out in right around 2009, and I'll touch on that toward the end, a little bit of updates on where we are with all of that. But so that's been a movement that has brought to light a lot of the differences and the cultural attitudes when it comes to disclosure of assets and how people deal with their government when it comes to their own personal finances. I just want to remind everyone, if you're online, there's a chat box. If anyone has questions as we go, and also, I think probably so that I don't have everyone on mute, or so that we don't have everyone off mute, if you have questions also, please feel free to email me during the presentation, and I've got my email up here, so people have questions as we go. Okay, and finally, there's legal capacity issues. So this is something, language and legal capacity issues. So if someone has, you know, I had a situation where I had someone in a South American country who needed a power of attorney to give power to a relative here in the U.S., and that relative in the U.S. Was handling an account that said South American person had here in the United States. And so South American person only spoke Spanish, and daughter spoke both, and of course powers of attorney in the U.S. are generally done in English. However, you can have powers of attorney and other things done in two languages. Because my first question was, how am I sure, as someone who does not speak Spanish, that if this person is my client, can he really be my client if I cannot communicate with him at all? And if I do a power of attorney in English and he signs it, I know that he is not understanding anything that he's signing. And so how are we going to document that to make sure in the future that someone doesn't turn around and say, oh, well, I had no idea what I was signing. So legal, determining his capacity. You know, I needed, before anyone signs a power of attorney or any legal document, I need to know that they have legal capacity to do so. There's no dementia. There's no, you know, misunderstanding of what's going on. How can I do that with some of these obstacles in the way? And so first thing we did was, of course, get counsel in Venezuela. We got legal counsel in Venezuela. That person spoke both English and Spanish and could be a go-between between me and the gentleman that was there. And so that attorney sat down and was basically the boots on the ground to make sure that, yes, that's what this gentleman really wanted. It wasn't something just coming from the relative in the U.S. That he, in fact, understood everything. We translate, so he signed both in English and Spanish language power of attorney so that the folks at the banks here who didn't speak Spanish could also know what it said and know that it was a legitimate power of attorney and that they could use it. So those are the kinds of hoops that sometimes we need to jump through. Again, having counsel in other countries is absolutely crucial. We can't do this kind of work without it. And so we were able to determine, yes, he had a full understanding. Yes, he was mentally competent in order to understand everything and sign this, knew what he was doing, wanted to do it, was under no undue influence or duress or anything from the relative here in the U.S., and, you know, everything was on the up and up. So those are some issues that are kind of unique to the cross-border situation in dealing with multinationals. Okay. Looks like we have a question. Let me grab that. Would I trust a family member as an interpreter? No, I wouldn't. Absolutely not. I would not. And it's simply because they have too much at interest. You know, so in this particular situation, it was the family member who was being named as the agent under the power of attorney for her father, who was in another country. Well, for all I know, you know, and I did not suspect anything from this lovely person that I was dealing with, but that doesn't matter, right? It just doesn't matter. What I needed an objective third party to verify that this gentleman knew exactly what he was doing. And the objective third party is someone who does not, will never ever, no matter what happens, have any interest in that person's finances. And that was not the case with this family member. Now, I mean, you could say, okay, what if there's an interpreter who's at an extended part of the family or whatever? Again, I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that only because it's a family, you know? I mean, there's all kinds of alliances and things going on in a family that I could never detect, you know, without sitting down with everyone for a good long while. So I wouldn't, you know, it's easy enough also that if you can't find a translator, there's translation services everywhere that they can take care of that. And again, they're objective. They don't care, right? They don't care whether power of attorney gets done or not done because they have no interest in it whatsoever. Okay. All right, so let's jump into, I'm going to jump to our main slide here, which is really, really crucial foundational concepts. With every single client, I start right here. I have for 20 years, it's the system I use. It helps me organize all of these rules in my brain. And this is what it is. There are four categories from the U.S. perspective of how the U.S. relates to a multinational individual. So when a client comes in and they're going to say, you know, I have U.S. citizenship, but I also have U.K. citizenship. I've been living in the U.S., but I think I might live, you know, move back to the U.K. My wife, by the way, is from Brazil. She's a citizen there, but not resident. Our children were born in Thailand. My job is thinking of maybe transferring you to Switzerland. What should I do? Okay, and you sit there and say, oh my gosh, I have no idea. There's so many countries. Where do we begin? So the first thing I do is I organize the situation, right? And I figure out, you know, who else do we need to get on board for this? I hear the UK, I hear Brazil, I hear Switzerland, and I'm the US person, okay? So I hear possibly three other jurisdictions. And that's normal, actually, for your typical multinational. I find that it's rare that there's only two countries involved. I find that it is more common that there's three or more countries involved, okay? We tend to have global families that even within that own family, there are different citizenships and residencies. I come from one of those families, which is why I went into this, which is why I think I match so well with this particular niche in law, is that we have, you know, in my original family, we have four separate citizenships, and I myself am a dual citizen now, and you know, and so that's only gonna continue, I believe. So, all right. So, what do? So, the first thing is U.S. citizenship. If someone is a U.S. citizen, whether they're a citizen of anywhere else, wherever they are resident, even if they're not resident in the U.S., but if a human being has U.S. citizenship, they are subject to estate tax in the U.S. on their gross estate wherever situated in the world, all right? So in a way, this is a very easy rule to apply because it says everything that I own in the entire world, no matter where I am, no matter where my assets are, is subject to the transfer tax in the United States, okay? Easy enough. But it's also a very broad reach. So for those of you who are used to other jurisdictions, many, many, many other jurisdictions only tax within their borders. They say if you're physically located within the borders, then we have jurisdiction over you. But the moment you leave, even if you're a citizen of there, but the moment you leave, we're going to stop taxing you. That's what most people are used to. And so when they come to the U.S., even if they've been here for a very long time, I had a client the other week who's, you know, he lived here for 30 years. He just went back to the U.K. And I said, yeah, do you realize, because he acquired U.S. citizenship while he was here, so he's dual. I said, do you realize that kind of no matter where you go and the fact that you have all these assets outside, you're still subject to the U.S. tax system? He did not. He was not happy. We can plan for that, you know, but he had no idea. And he's lived here for 30 years. So, I mean, most people, they really, really don't know. Okay, so that's first rule. Second rule is U.S. residents. So, again, these are the people. What is a U.S. resident? I'm going to touch on that in a second. The rule for U.S. residency is different from that of income tax. It is different from that of immigration. It is its own rule for estate and gift tax purposes. All right? The result of the rule is the same. It's your gross estate wherever situated in the world. All right? But those are for U.S. residents. Third category is U.S. situs property. So I'm not a citizen. I'm not a resident of the U.S., but I have property that is deemed to have situs in the U.S. That property is subject to the U.S. to the estate tax. Nothing else is, however. Okay, so we would refer to these folks as non-resident aliens, but owning U.S. property. So I'm a Singapore citizen. I am resident in Switzerland. I bought a Florida condo because I need sun in the wintertime. That Florida condo is U.S. situs property, is subject to U.S. estate law. But nothing else is, okay? Then we have a category of people who have left. Expatriate is a person who's given up citizenship, and former U.S. residents, so those people who used to be legal permanent residents but are no longer, if they've left after June 16th of 2008, about 10 years ago, they have a separate rule, which I'll touch on, okay? We just got rid of an older rule that was a 10-year rule that really just expired. And so we just have now this rule in place for expatriates and former U.S. residents. Okay, what's our exemption amount? Our exemption amount is $11.2 million in 2018. That is really high. In 2017, it used to be $5.5 million, and it just went up as part of the new tax code. Estate attorneys have been trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future with this. This number has been going up, it's been going down. I don't know where it's going to wind up, but we're doing all kinds of very flexible estate plans to make sure that people don't have to continue coming back and updating their estate plan every time politicians play with that thing. That's for citizens and residents, is the 11.2. For non-resident aliens, for everyone outside the U.S. who may have U.S. property, the exemption amount is still the same exemption amount it has been for over 40 years, which is $60,000, 6-0, $60,000. All right? So beware, you do not have to be a wealthy person with $11 million to be subject to the U.S. estate tax. You could be someone who has $300,000 in the entire world. 100,000 of it is located in the United States in that Florida condo you bought. The 100,000 is over 60,000. At the death of that non-resident alien, they are subject to federal estate tax. They file Form 706NA. There's an exemption amount of 60,000. They're going to owe about $5,000 or so in federal estate tax, and they can't get rid of that house or transfer title until that's paid. So just keep in mind, non-resident aliens, those folks, Category 3 with the U.S. situs property here, those are the people, their exemption amount, only $60,000. Those folks need to plan, okay? All right. I'm going to touch on residency very quickly because I do want to get to our other topics. A resident for estate tax purposes, it is a gray area. definition. It is not a bright line test. It's not a black and white test. And it's basically those who live in the U.S. with no definite present intention of leaving. So this is a test of intention. And so in determining intent, the IRS is going to look at all kinds of factors, such as where do you own homes, where are your personal ties, where's your burial site, what does your passport say, where do you file tax returns, what do you state as your address on that tax return, what do your legal documents list as your domicile, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They take a look at all of that and then ask, does it seem like this person was that they had the intention to stay in the U.S. indefinitely, or did it look more like someone who was here temporarily? And maybe as soon as their job ends, they're going to return to their country of origin, or they're going to sort of, you know, get rid of the U.S. house and stay in the other country or whatever. Those are the things that they're going to take a look at. It is a gray area, and again, it's an area of planning where if someone really does want to evidence U.S. residency, then we make sure that they really evidence that by all of these factors. And if they really don't want to evidence that, then we make sure that they don't evidence that by all of these factors. So that's the planning area as well, where we can say, where do you really want to be, or where do you need to be? And then let's make it really clear that that's where you want to be. Okay? The residency is a big issue. We have a question. For a U.S. resident, how long can someone hold green card status? Unlimited, or must they apply repeatedly? I'm not an immigration attorney, so I don't really know the answer to that question. I mean, just from working with my clients and people in my own family, they've had green card status for 50 years, and they have to renew, but every 10 years, I believe it is, but they're able to renew it. And I also believe that some people at different times did not have to renew. I'm not 100% sure about that. Ultimately, that's an immigration question, and I believe that the answer to that question has changed over time also. So, okay. Oh, someone's going to answer. Thank you so much. Marta Gold is an immigration attorney. Green card status can be renewed every 10 years. There's no limit on time. Thank you. All right. There's your answer. Okay. So I'm going to contrast the residency rule that we just went over with estate tax with income tax, really just to make sure that it isn't confused. It is entirely possible for someone to be an income tax resident of the U.S., but to be a non-resident when it comes to estate tax, okay? So for income tax in the U.S., we have very similar rules. If you're a U.S. citizen, you're taxed on your worldwide income wherever you or the income is located. If you are a U.S. resident, same rule, worldwide income, wherever you or the income is located. If you are neither a U.S. citizen nor a U.S. resident, then you are taxed only on U.S. source income. All right? And lawful permanent residents are deemed to be resident for U.S. income tax purposes. Okay, so again, we just went over an estate tax residency test that was all about intention. Now we're going over the residency test for income tax purposes, and this, in general, is a black and white test. You are counting up days of physical presence in the U.S., and if you're over a certain amount, you're resident, and if you're under a certain amount, you're non-resident, and it's very clear. It's one or the other. Estate tax purposes, totally different. Okay? All right. Let me jump to a very, very common issue in U.S. law that people need to be wary of when it comes to estate tax. So we're back to estate tax now. Normally, for U.S. citizens, if one spouse dies and leaves everything to surviving spouse, they still have to file, if they're over an exemption amount, they still have to file a estate tax return. However, they get an unlimited marital deduction against that. And so usually, if you have a married couple and one of them dies leaving everything to the surviving spouse, you are not going to have to pay any federal estate tax at that death. Okay, so it's a common thing we have throughout a lot of our tax law is sort of anything to a spouse is a little bit of a freebie, okay, at least for now. The U.S. estate tax has this unlimited marital deduction. If I die tomorrow, I leave $20 million to my surviving spouse. I have to file a return. I say I've got $20 million in assets. I take a $20 million deduction, and that leaves me with zero. So no taxes due. Okay? That is not the case if my surviving spouse is anything other than a U.S. citizen. So if my surviving spouse is a U.S. resident, meaning long-term green card holder, lived here for 50 years, doesn't matter, not a citizen, no unlimited marital deduction. There's a limited marital deduction of $152,000, probably not going to get you very far. And that's in 2018. That deduction is indexed for inflation. Okay? So the status of the surviving spouse is what matters. It doesn't matter what the status of the deceased spouse is. So if I pass away and I'm a U.S. resident or a non-resident alien and I'm transferring to a U.S. citizen spouse, that citizen spouse gets the marital deduction, right? Because it's only the status of the surviving spouse that must be U.S. citizen, not of the transferring spouse, okay? So is there ways to plan around this? Yes, there is. Two ways. Number one, incorporate a qualified domestic trust into that couple's estate plan. Essentially what that does is it retains jurisdiction in the U.S. of any assets that find their way into that qualified domestic trust. So the U.S. says, you can take your unlimited marital deduction right now, because we know at the death of surviving spouse, we can collect our tax at that time. So it mimics what would have happened had there been two citizen spouse, it mimics what would have happened if the surviving spouse would have been a citizen in the first place. Okay? So this isn't meant to punish or anything. The only thing it does is say, it's the U.S. says, give me the jurisdiction to tax in the future and I'll give you your marital deduction now. So that's what a qualified domestic trust does. Wonderful thing about qualified domestic trust, you can set them up. If you're a planner, you set them up ahead of time within the estate plan. If you forget, like most people do, you can actually create that after the death of the spouse, when non-citizen spouse is sitting there looking at a very large federal estate tax bill, you can set up a postmortem qualified domestic trust and still get the marital deduction. All right? So again, the IRS isn't out to punish people. They just, they're after jurisdiction. So if you give it to them, you'll get that deduction. The other solution is become a U.S. citizen. So the spouse can just become a U.S. citizen after the death of the spouse or before, right? I've got plenty of couples, they come and they go, you know what, we've been meaning to become citizens. We've never gotten around to it. We've been here for years. And I say, you know, looking at the rest of their situation, if it works for them, yes, become a U.S. citizen. It'll make your lives easier. Just a couple of weeks ago, I met with their dual citizens, Canadian, this Canadian couple, been in the U.S., plans on staying here, all their kids are U.S. They said, we've been meaning to become U.S. citizens. I said, go become U.S. citizens. We don't need to incorporate all this qualified domestic stuff in your plan. So that's what they're going to do. You can do that before. You can also do it after. Had that happen, someone passes away, surviving spouse is not a citizen, surviving spouse rushes out, gets that citizenship test, and hopefully gets the citizenship within the time frame. It's essentially 15 months after death. You can put the estate tax return on extension before that, before the deduction, you know, can take place. Okay, I have a few questions. Let me get to them. Someone asked, has the substantial presence test been removed? No, it hasn't. The counting up the days is the substantial presence test. Okay, so that's the same thing. And I'm sorry, this is going back to income tax, who's a resident and who's not. The substantial presence test is the test of counting up how many days you've been physically present in the U.S. If you're over a certain amount, you're an income tax resident. If you're under a certain amount, you're not a resident. That is the substantial presence test. Okay, a couple of other questions. Can you be considered a U.S. domiciliary if you're a green card holder living outside the U.S. and therefore get the $11.2 million estate tax exemption? All right, so that's a great question. Again, the resident test for estate purposes is one of intention. So if you are a green card holder, that is one of the factors in determining of whether you're a resident or not. So immigration status is a factor, but it is not definitive. And there's a lot of revenue rulings and other things that say, I mean, green card holder is a pretty strong factor. I will say that. I mean, permanent resident is, it has the word permanent in there. And so I think it is a very tough argument to say, to try to argue that you don't intend on staying somewhere permanently when you have something that says permanent resident. However, a lot of people leave and they sort of never forget to give up the green card, or they really don't have the intention. It's an argument that can be made. It's not definitive one way or the other. But I think if you're a green card holder, unless you've got strong arguments that say that you just forgot and never got around to getting rid of that green card, and you've actually been living overseas for years and years and had no connection to the U.S., you know, that's a situation where you could say, hey, you could argue that I'm really not a resident for estate tax purposes, and you could probably get somewhere with that. Otherwise, if you're just out temporarily or on a job or something like that, but you've got the green card, I think you've got a tougher argument there. Another question, can the QDOT be sped down? Absolutely, it can. However, when distributions come out of the QDOT, they are subject to federal estate tax unless they're for hardship purposes. So it is very much, it mimics, you know, the philosophy of the IRS that says, we don't want to lose our taxing jurisdiction. So let's say you put, you know, $2 million in a QDOT and it's sitting there. The surviving spouse gets all the income from that QDOT, but its principal, and that's not taxed for federal estate tax purposes. It is for income, but it would be anyway under any scenario. But for if you're taking principal out of the QDOT, then that is taxable. You've got to file a form 706.QDT each year that says, like, here's what was in the QDOT, here was the activity, and if any distributions of principal came out, you're going to owe federal estate tax on that. You can argue for hardship. You know, you can say that the QDOT is the only asset that the surviving spouse has. There's no other assets. There's no way surviving spouse can live without the QDOT, and you'll probably get a hardship exemption on that. Okay. I'm just watching my time, and I really want to get to our topics here, so I'm sorry we're running a little bit behind. postmortem QDOT. And, okay, let me jump to, I do want to talk about expatriation. When people want to leave, or perhaps they plan to leave, expatriation can absolutely be an estate planning technique, okay, and I've worked with some of the immigration attorneys that are on in having people leave the U.S., either give up a green card, either give up U.S. residency, or give up U.S. citizenship in order to be away from the U.S. tax system. Okay. Or I should say, you know, so that can be an estate planning technique, but it's also a lot of times when someone just has to do that, you know, because the job is ending or something and they're going back to country of origin, then we want to make sure that their estate is done properly, you know, with that. So this old rule that is now defunct as of this June, just a few months ago, was called the 10-year rule. This 10-year rule was created in 2008 for anyone leaving anyone expatriating prior to June 17, 2008, and essentially the U.S. kept tabs on those people for 10 years. And if they died within 10 years of leaving in that time frame, then they were still subject to U.S. estate tax in certain circumstances. But basically for people with wealth that would have been subject to estate tax, they were subject to estate tax in that 10-year time frame. That 10 years ended in June of 2018. So anyone who expatriated prior to June 17, 2008 is free of U.S. jurisdiction. All right? What's the new rule? The new rule, old rule was Section 877, new rule is 877 capital A. This applies to covered expatriates, so either people giving up U.S. citizenship or people giving up U.S. residency who leave on or after June 17, 2008. There is no end to this law. There is no expiration after 10 years like the old rule. It is open-ended. Who does this apply to? Essentially, it applies to wealthy folks. And how do we determine wealthy folks? Let me get to, sorry, I don't think I have my net worth test. Where is my net worth? Here we go. Net worth test is, if you meet any of these scenarios, your annual net income tax is over $165,000. That's our year for 2018, for the 5 years preceding the expatriation. This is not annual income. This is annual income tax. So people are paying $165,000 in tax. So we're looking at $400,000-ish, depending on how you file for income tax purposes, of income. A lot of income. These are high income people. Second prong is an estate of $2 million or above. Kind of wealthy, but not super wealthy. All right? So anyone $2 million or above leaving, giving up the green card, giving up citizenship, is possibly subject to this tax. A third prong is if you fail to certify tax compliance. All this means is that if you did it wrong, if you left without filing everything you're supposed to file with the IRS, then they are keeping tabs on you even if you don't have the $2 million or a high income. So this is really a way that the IRS just said, oh no, we're really serious when we tell you you need to file your paperwork with us. Okay, so that's why they added that on there. All right, so if you meet any of those three things, you're subject to, when leaving, what are you subject to? You're subject to an exit tax. It's a mark-to-market exit tax. It triggers capital gain on all worldwide property. It is a trigger of capital gain. There is an exclusion amount, however, of that capital gain, and that exclusion amount is $713,000. That's indexed for inflation. So if I had an estate of $3 million, I am deemed to have sold it all on the day that I expatriate from the U.S., and yet I had only $600,000 of gain, I'm not going to owe anything because I'm going to apply my capital gain of $713,000, and I'm going to be okay. Just a few years ago, we were saying no one has any gain anyway because of the way the markets have been and the housing and all that kind of thing. Now, in more recent years, yes, you know, assets are up, so maybe some of that capital gain is back in there. Of course, it depends when you arrived. So for green card holders, it's the day you got your green card. For citizens, it's the day you were a citizen. Okay. Let me talk a little bit about green card holders on that. In order for a green card holder who is giving up that green card to be subject to this exit tax, they have to have held the green card for at least 8 out of the previous 15 years. So what we've done with a lot of green card holders is they're getting to year 6 and 7, and we're saying to them, are you going to stay? You think you might leave? Maybe a change in immigration status is what you need. And we've done this with clients is that we've said, let's take you from green card holder to visa, and let's do that instead. And that has worked for them. That is one way to avoid a trigger of capital gain when giving up the green card, and that's for clients too. And I had a client do this and represented him for a very long time. Big executive, had plenty of capital gain, and gave up the green card in year 7 as, you know, in order to plan, and he is, in fact, has not been back in the U.S., you know, sort of knew that in the short term he really would be leaving, you know, and would not be needing that green card. You know, again, just because of career, because of job prospects and that kind of thing. And in fact did that, but was sure to do it in year 7 so that he did not walk into this exit tax here. So that is absolutely something that you know, like I said, some change in immigration status can absolutely be a an estate planning technique. Okay. Again, I'm looking at my time, so I'm gonna do a quick foreign account compliance update because there have been changes just recently in the past few weeks. I want to touch on that, and I just want to answer a couple of more questions. You know, we are at 10 o'clock, so I know I promised an hour. I'm happy to continue here. The other thing is I am recording this, so again, if you want to hear it again or pass it on to someone who could use it, I will be emailing it out. I'll be emailing out the recording to everyone. Okay. Quick note on offshore account compliance. Things have changed fairly drastically in the last few weeks. What is offshore account compliance? Okay, so in 2009, the IRS woke up in the U.S. and said, hey, any U.S. taxpayer who has not been reporting, or any U.S. person, I should say, either a citizen or an income tax resident, who should have been reporting their foreign bank accounts and the income off those accounts that has not been doing so, we are going to wallop you with huge and scary penalties unless you enter our offshore voluntary disclosure initiative. The voluntary makes me laugh a little bit because it was their very powerful arguments to enter that program. However, here are some of the, if someone was not reporting the income, which we understand, right? You are supposed to report that income and pay tax on it. And if that wasn't being done, then those people need to be in compliance. There were other things that people need to file. Reporting forms, such as an FBAR form, commonly known as an FBAR, it's now FinCEN 114, to report a foreign bank and financial account. Also, forms like 3520, 3520A, if you have trusts or foreign trusts. Form 8938 was actually a form that goes along with your tax return in the U.S. That form was not invented until 2011. As part of this whole foreign account compliance process. The scary penalties, if you do not file those forms, are what got everyone in, got everyone's attention, are still getting people's attention, and are getting them into these programs. So if you were deemed to be willful in your not including your income on that return or not filing that FBAR form, you had a maximum penalty of the greater of $100,000 or 50% of the balance of the account for each year of the violation. So the IRS scared a lot of people by saying, we're going to come after you for at least $100,000, oh my gosh, or 50% if the account's more than that. If I have a $500,000 account, I could be penalized to the tune of $250,000. Not only that, it's not just in year, 2006 that I didn't file my FR. I also didn't file them in 2007 or 2008. That's 3 years of which I am penalized 50% of the value of the account each year. So not only could the account be completely exhausted, but then I would continue to owe even more to the IRS. These are incredibly scary penalties. That was if, and these programs first came out, where the IRS was assuming everyone had done this willfully, and they were treating everyone as if they were willful. Really scary. So it started with, and I'm going to jump to, first version of the OBDI program was announced in 2009, and it was the deal was, we'll go back to 2003, we'll go back 6 years, we'll only do a flat 20% penalty on the highest value of all the accounts in lieu of all other penalties. Huge program, very popular. Government made a lot of money. In 2011, they revamped the program. The penalty went up a bit, but for all those people who had paid all their tax but forgot all those reporting forms, they didn't have to go into the program. All right? So we weren't punishing people for just forgetting to file a form. Okay? We weren't accusing those people of being willful for just not filing a form. So they took them out of the program and said, you know what, file all your forms. We know that, you know, we've gotten our tax the whole way, so So, you know, you don't need to get into this program. 2012, it was revamped again. Penalty went up again a little bit, 27.5. There were some exceptions with much lesser penalties because through the years, the IRS is getting to know why did people not have the tax on there or why didn't they file the reporting forms. Okay, so they carved out a couple of exceptions with low penalties like 5% of the value of the account. In 2014, the streamlined program was introduced, which basically took those lesser penalties and put them into a separate program. This separate program said, all right, you can either go into the traditional offshore voluntary program if things were willful, but if things weren't willful, go ahead and try to get into the streamlined program. As of September 28th, a couple of weeks ago, OBDI was terminated when it came to foreign account compliance. That program is no longer there. What is still there is the streamlined program, however. So if you have clients who are still going back several years and they have not gotten into compliance with the IRS, there is a streamlined program. They have to do a statement evidencing their lack of willfulness in failing to file reports of tax or the reporting forms. You obviously have to do your amended returns and make sure you get your taxes paid. There's a 5% penalty on the highest value of the foreign financial asset, only 5%. It only reaches back 6 years for those FBAR reporting forms. It only reaches back 3 years for tax returns. Some of the downside, there's no closing letter. You can still be audited at any time. And the other is that so far, again, this program has no closing date. But, of course, the IRS could make an announcement at any time that they're going to turn off this program. Okay? All right. So that's the update. OVDI, that Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program, is no more. It's gone. Streamlined program is in its place. Worked with a lot of clients on getting things through there. Knock on wood, so far, I haven't had anyone booted out of that program yet. I haven't had the IRS come back and say, heck, you were willful all along and we don't believe this statement one bit. So far, knock on wood, I haven't had that happen. So it seems to be a pretty good program. All right, I'm going to answer a couple of questions. I'm sorry, I know that I'm... all right, I have one question. So let's go back to post-mortem QDOT or planning for non-citizen spouse after the fact. So in the scenario where the surviving non-citizen spouse becomes a U.S. citizen within the 15-month period after death, do they receive the benefit of exemption portability as well? Yes. And they would anyway. So what this person is referring to is there's portability, meaning that if one spouse does not use the exemption amount, that what is now $11.2 million, the concept of portability was put into our law just a few years ago that basically said if spouse number one does not use up their exemption amount because instead everything passes to surviving spouse by way of a marital deduction, then they can still file for portability. So surviving spouse can use the exemption amount of deceased spouse that they didn't use plus their own. So portability is still available to U.S. residents because they still get that exemption amount. Okay? So yes. I mean, the short answer to that question was yes. And let me take another question here. Are there ways around the exit tax? I heard about using trust. You betcha. There are ways of exit tax. So if you can plan ahead, especially with a green card holder, and you've passed that 8 years. You know, you haven't been able to do planning prior to hitting the 8-year mark, but you're well past the 8 years. You can still plan around it because if that person is a U.S. resident, they still have a sizable exemption amount. And that exemption amount can be used in planning. So, for instance, something put in a trust or something like that before the person formally leaves the U.S. and gives up that green card. So that's exactly what we do is we take exemption amount, we use it to its extent while the person is still a U.S. resident, and then you can also continue to do planning after the person is no longer a U.S. resident and still possibly do some transfers that are needed with their assets at that time. Okay, let me wrap up because now I've got sound interrupting me where I am, and we have gone over. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining. Please feel free to send me questions via email. Give me a call, whatever. I'm happy everyone is on the call. And for those of you who are Pennsylvania trying to get CLE, the code word is foreign. And so if you need to apply for CLE, reach out to me because this is approved for CLE credit if you're a Pennsylvania attorney. All right. Thank you so much, everyone.